Hello everyone, this is Liz Denery Sanders of SheBrand, and I am so excited because I am in conversation today with somebody who I really admire. I love her work. You may have heard of her, Andrea Owen, who is already a best-selling author, a mentor, and a certified life coach who helps high-achieving women let go of perfectionism, control, and isolation, and choosing courage and confidence instead. I am sure that there are a few people listening who can relate to that, myself included. She has helped thousands of women manage their inner critic to create loving connections and live their most kick-ass life. She is the proud author of 52 Ways to Live a Kick-Ass Life, BS-Free Wisdom to Ignite Your Inner Badass and Live the Life You Deserve. And her second book, which we're going to talk about today, is How to Stop Feeling Like Shit, 14 Habits That Are Holding You Back from Happiness. And that book is out on January 2nd, 2018. And when Andrea isn't juggling her full-time coaching practice or hosting retreats, she is often busy competing in triathlons and chasing her 10-year-old son and 8-year-old daughter. And I find this interesting. She is also a retired roller derby player, having skated under the name Veronica Vane. Andrea, welcome.
Thank you, Liz. I'll never get tired of hearing that bio.
Right? It's awesome. It is so awesome. Are you still skating at all or no?
I'm wondering if something really interesting. So I haven't skated since I retired in 2013. I hurt my shoulder really bad, and it's still actually injured, and I never went back. And then just recently, I have thought about going back and email the Greensboro roller derby team to get information about it, and they just emailed me back literally yesterday.
Wow.
I haven't even broken the news to my husband that I might go back. But if I do, I'm going to commit for a year, because I'm to be in roller derby shape is holy Moses, so I've got some work to do.
Well, if you're participating in triathlons, I would think that you're in pretty darn good shape.
I haven't done a triathlon in a minute.
Okay.
So I've taken a break. I know every time I hear that bio and I'm like, I probably should adjust that, because it's been a minute since I've done one. I've done running races, but that's different. Running is different than roller derby. It's a whole nother ballgame.
A whole nother group of muscles, right?
Yes, it
is. And different mindset. Completely different.
And falling on the concrete is no joke.
Seriously.
When you're 42.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, so I have to ask, because your first book, which I loved, came out a few years ago. Why did you decide to write another book, particularly this one?
I think, well, it's funny. It's sort of like having children. You know, you have one, and then someone's like, when are you going to have another one? And you're like, never. That's sort of what I felt about the first book, because it took so much out of me, both creatively and asked a lot of me in terms of my own emotional being out there in front of people, and definitely asked me to play a bigger game. So there was a lot of growth that came out of that, and I needed a break for a while. But as many writers and authors say, we don't find books, books find us. And I think that happened with this book. And when it really sort of was born is in 2014, I was certified in the work of Dr. Brené Brown with her and her senior faculty, and in what they call the Daring Way. And for people listening that aren't familiar with her, she's a researcher and author who has dedicated her life to studying and teaching the topics of shame and connection and courage and authenticity, just to name a few. And that work, honestly, Liz, like, changed my life both professionally and personally. And what started to happen is I started to pay attention to my own behaviors in my life, the things I was doing that I felt like they were protecting me, you know, the perfectionism, the people-pleasing, the high-achieving, or the overachieving, I should say, control and things like that. But they were actually, and the way I described it was, they were actually making me feel like shit. And I also saw this pattern that I saw in my clients and women who were taking my classes. And I sent out a survey around 2015, and I asked women, okay, which of these things do you struggle with the most? And it was perfectionism, control, hiding and isolating, numbing out, and people-pleasing, I think it was.
Yeah.
And there was no real winner. They all said, I struggle with all of those. Can I take all of the above? So it was then that I really started paying attention to these behaviors. And I sat down one day and there I came up with 14 that I saw chronically, some more than others, but chronically in myself and in the women that I served. And then that's how the book was born.
Yeah, I mean, and I see a very common thread as well, particularly in women entrepreneurs, you know, women mm-hmm. that are doing their own thing business-wise. They tend to be very high achievers. There tend to be, you know, type A personality, you know, that type of thing. And I would think that there is a common thread that runs through a lot of these habits.
There is a common thread, and that common thread typically is that we're trying to engineer our life to look a certain way and be a certain way, but what I'm specifically talking about is looking a certain way to other people, because we're trying to avoid criticism and failure and shame and just that pain of all of that, mm-hmm. so that we engage in all these behaviors. And I want to say one thing real quick. I'm not telling people, like, hey, we need to stop all of these behaviors, stat. They're ruining your life. What I'm saying is, hey, we all do these things. So it's not a matter of stopping them. It's a matter of knowing when you're doing it and trying to know fairly quickly when you're in it, because it's never in alignment with your values of who you really want to be. And getting out in front of it and choosing behaviors that feel better versus these ones that you've been doing chronically that end up not feeling good.
Yeah. Well, so obviously you wrote the book. I've just recently read an early copy, thank you. You know, but most of our listeners right now have not read the book yet, but hopefully after our call today, we'll understand the importance of it. Can you give us, you know, just a quick synopsis of what the book is about and why it's so important for women right now?
I think it's important for women right now because, you know, it's the giant elephant in the room, and no one's arguing that. This is an interesting time for women. This is a powerful time for women, and women are looking around and needing the tools to change behaviors that they're used to. So, for example, let's look at people-pleasing for a minute. And saying yes to things that, you know, we've been conditioned to make other people comfortable before we make ourselves comfortable, right? And to say yes to things that we really don't want to do. And to change that is sometimes like asking someone to completely change everything about their life. It's very uncomfortable. And to, you know, answer the first part of your question, that is, the book is about these 14 things that we did, people pleasing is one of them. And I think that what is underneath it all is vulnerability, really, because in order to say no and set boundaries, I go through that in the book, like, what the hell is a boundary? How do we set one? What do we actually say? What are the steps? I go through that. But to actually set a boundary and hold on to it, that is like an act of revolution for many women. I call that, you know, that is raising hell in your own life to actually set a boundary and stick to it, or to really look at when you are trying to achieve in order to look a certain way, in order to gain your own validation and worthiness and esteem yourself through your achievements, to actually admit that and look at that and do things that are actually more in alignment with your values, that is an act of revolution. And I think that women now, I think many of them are overwhelmed with what to do. Okay, now people are listening to us. What do I do? You know, now people are actually willing to share my story. How do I do that? I think that some of the biggest work that you'll do in your life is the work on yourself. And that can, I think many people underestimate how powerful that can be, the work on yourself.
Yes, 100%. And, you know, you talk about how these specific 14 habits are holding women back from real happiness. And what they are doing is it's sort of, you know, masking our own vulnerability, right? Because mm-hmm. vulnerability feels scary. Which is very tied into Brené Brown's work, mm-hmm. you know, on vulnerability and courage and also shame. And so I'm curious, you know, what does shame have to do with the 14 habits?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had a handful of women come to me and almost, you know, sheepishly say, I really like Brené's work, but I don't feel like I walk around feeling shame. I don't even feel like I have any shame in my life. And I totally get it. I don't think, you know, I would say all of the women that have come to me to work with me privately don't outwardly walk around, you know, their tail between their legs and feeling ashamed. So where the shame fits into all of this is, you know, you get to a certain point in your life, like I think all of us, and you know what shame feels like, consciously or unconsciously. I tell the story in the book about when I was in seventh grade math, and my teacher used to do weekly quizzes, and if we got anything less than a C, if we got a D or an F on these weekly quizzes, he would staple a half a sheet of paper on the top of it, and we had to take that home and get it signed by our parents, and he called it a tag. So if you got a tag on your quiz, on your math quiz, the entire class knew about it because he would hand those out last. They were at the bottom of the stack, so he would start handing back these quizzes, and, you know, you knew. It was like this tension in the room. You know, everyone knew who was getting tagged. And I remember there was a period of time where I was just terrible at math, and getting this handed back to me, and just that feeling of just overwhelming shame in front of my peers, in front of my teacher, and then having to go home and talk to my parents about it. So we know what that feels like. That stays with us. It's a visceral feeling. Brené Brown calls shame a full contact emotion.
Yes.
And it's not that story has stayed with me and affected me terribly my entire life and has stopped me from going after jobs or, you know, asking men out. That's not it at all. What's actually happening, though, is because my body and my mind know exactly what that is, I'm doing things to avoid that again at all costs.
Yes.
Absolutely, positively. What can I do to never have that feeling again? So that's where isolation and hiding out comes from. That's where numbing out comes from. That's where basically all of these behaviors come from, in an effort to avoid that. So whether you know it or not, shame is running your life. So yeah. I'm a big fan of, like, let's know it. Let's be aware of it. Knowledge is power. We all know this. The more aware we are, the more we can try to live our life that, again, is in more alignment with the women that we actually want to be.
I love it. You know, you talk about in the book how none of us escape childhood unscathed, right?
Like
we all have issues, you know,
something that
parents
happens.
Or situations that happen, like you know, you talked about it at school or with friends. I mean, we all have these issues that have transpired that trigger behaviors to protect ourselves from ever having to feel that way again.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I agree with you. It seems that there is this common thread that runs through, you know, many, if not all, of these behaviors that are the result of, at the end of the day, feeling shame long ago.
Yeah. And I want to say one more thing about that. There's a saying, and I got sober in 2011, and I identify as being an alcoholic. I'm someone in long-term recovery. And there's a saying in the rooms of recovery that says, it works until it doesn't. And I believe that that's true with these behaviors. You know, overachieving and perfectionism got me to graduate with honors from college. You know, people pleasing might have got me to get a promotion. And sometimes these behaviors, and I would even venture to say many times, these behaviors work for us and get us to where we are.
Absolutely.
At work, like, it's sometimes great to have somebody who really struggled with control on your team because they're pretty damn efficient, right?
Absolutely.
They work. So it's about, like, when does it cross the line for you? When does it start to negatively affect your life? When do you get so exhausted from perfectionism, from overachieving, that you cannot stand it anymore? That's what I want women to think about.
Yeah, and I would even say that there's a good side, if you can call it a good side,
mm-hmm.
and then a very dark side. Like, I look at my own perfectionism and control, which in my own business has actually come in very handy in terms of, you know, being hyper-organized and managing certain things, and particularly as a creative director,
yes.
and having, you know, a meticulous eye for detail and looking, but that has helped to create amazing things for clients.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, it has also driven me too much,
mm-hmm.
sometimes to exhaustion or, you know, into places where I'm not very happy with it. So, you know, and so it sort of flip-flops back and forth from sometimes
yeah.
being a good thing to many times you know, not being a good thing at all, I'll share a really interesting story. Literally like 13 or 14 years ago, a coach challenged me to send a letter to a client with a typo in it. And I could
not do it.
I couldn't do it.
You can
now,
do it.
Fast forward to, you know, 6 or 7 years later, and I started practicing that to learn that, you know, the world does not cave in. It is not a catastrophe. You know, people all of a sudden don't say, oh, my God, she has a typo in that letter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it just wasn't the end of the world. But, you know, 14 years ago, I couldn't bring myself to do it. So to your point, I do think it's sort of this gradual process of, you know, awareness over time and practice over time that really makes a difference.
I love that you said that. And it is a flip-flopping. And again, like, I just want to kind of underscore that, because this isn't about stopping doing these behaviors forever and ever and ever. It's about, like, knowing when it's actually working for you, because, hey, I like to get things done really well, too. I have a value around excellence, but it's about knowing when am I trying to be perfect so that I can look that way in front of other people? When am I trying to engineer my life to be and look a certain way so that I get validation or accolades from other people, et cetera, et cetera? It's all about that awareness.
100%. You know, you had a personal crisis while you were writing this book. How did that change things for you?
I did. I had an unexpected death in my family. So I wrote this book in 2016, and my deadline for turning in the manuscript was December 31st of that year. And in late September, I went on a family vacation with my kids and my husband, and right before we left, my stepmother called me and said that my dad had been put in the hospital, and he was anemic and had a blood transfusion. They weren't sure what was going on with them. And I considered not going. We were going on a Disney cruise, cause, you know, and then, like, you can't get a hold of anybody when you're out there. And so we went anyway. She told me to go, and then upon our return, it was September 30th, and he was diagnosed with a rare form of leukemia, and it was terminal. And I had just seen him in June, and he was fine. He was my regular dad. And then I flew back to San Diego, where I'm from, and saw him, and I knew it was imminent. It was going to be soon. And he died on October 16th, just a couple of weeks later, and I was with him when, I was with him when he died. It was just he and I. And I had never lost anyone before that, Liz. Like, I had never even lost a pet that I was close to. And it was excruciating, you know, obviously. And the grief was... You know, and I'm someone who really just started to learn how to feel her feelings, like, when I got sober in 2011. So this was all very new to me. If I had still been drinking when he died, I would have drank my way through it.
Yeah.
There's no way I could have trusted myself enough to handle that kind of pain. Mm-hmm. And then I had to go home and finish the book, and that was interesting. I took actually a month off and got a little bit of extra time from the publisher, and was able to finish it. But what was interesting about that is, you know, here I am writing a book about all the behaviors that we do to try to avoid pain and try to avoid life. And here I am faced with this gigantic crisis.
Mm.
And I thought to myself, I remember, like, flying home and thinking, like, am I going to eat my own words on this? Am I going to be, like, a total hypocrite and fall back on all these behaviors and of course, have to tell everybody about it? And the truth is I did a little bit. For instance, the minute I found out that he was terminal, I drove to the mall and went and bought, he wasn't even dead yet, and I bought a dress and a pair of shoes for his service, because I could not imagine not having the right outfit for that. And that was me just not being able to deal with the thought of my father dying. So I'm going to go shopping and do this too, because I want to change the way I feel. And that, you know, that made me happy for about 10 minutes, and then I had to go back to it. So I'm a big believer in telling the truth.
Of course.
And it wasn't about beating myself up for it. It wasn't about, you know, being so hard on myself. You know, I'm a human, and we do these things because life is hard, and we know certain coping skills. And I'm 42. You know, I did those coping skills for a long time. There's truth to the cliche, old habits die hard.
Yeah, and it never really ends, right? We don't get to this final destination where, you know, everything is, you know, unicorns and rainbows and happy, and, you know, we know what we're doing all the time. And I mean, not at all. I mean, it's
the work is constant.
Messy. Yeah, it's constant.
The work is constant, and it's not linear at all. And it just, it was really rough, but it really showed me how resilient I really am, especially, you know, I have a whole chapter on numbing out and actually what it is like to feel your feelings. And that for me was the biggest test for me. Do I trust myself enough to walk into this grief and totally surrender to it? I got the word surrender tattooed on my arm 2 months after my dad died, because that his death was the biggest lesson in surrender I could have ever experienced. And I've given birth to 2 children. I'm like, that is a huge lesson. Like giving birth and just like letting your body expel this thing and do what it knows how to do. That was a lesson. But man, this grief was even more of a lesson.
Huge one. It's almost like the universe, you know, obviously knew that you were writing this book and held up this huge mirror to you and said, okay, we're going to give you this opportunity to practice.
There you go. What are you going to do?
We're going to give you one of the most difficult challenges there is, right? Losing a parent, losing a dear loved one. And we're going to give you this opportunity to walk your talk.
Yeah. It's been such an interesting lesson. I mean, and it's what's funny, too, is that I was able to kind of almost laugh at myself at times, because during this whole thing, sorry, there's an alarm going off on my phone, and I'm like, how did this happen? Okay, stop it. During this whole thing, you know, people kind of give you advice, and they're so beautiful and well-meaning, and one of the pieces of advice I got was, you know, the first Christmas is going to be really hard, and then his birthday and your birthday, et cetera, et cetera. So as those dates started to come, I braced myself for them, you know, and I even, like, would block out my calendar. I think it was Father's Day. I remember I just was like, I told my husband I don't want to do anything. But I was okay. You know, that day came and went, and I was like, oh, it's okay. But then one day, it was during the summer, just this past summer, we were at Myrtle Beach, and we're just, me and my family are sitting there at the beach, and there was someone flying a kite. I don't even know if it was a father, daughter, or anything like that. There was a kite, and I hadn't seen a kite in a long time, and I'm looking over at this kite, and I get this swooping in memory of being at the park with my dad when I was probably 7 and him teaching me how to fly a kite. And I could suddenly, like, I was transported back, and I could hear even, like, I might cry when I tell a story, but like I could hear him running and like telling, you know, running behind me and how to fly the kite and like get a fly. I could hear all of this whole narration of this memory that had been lost for so long, you know, and I'm 42 and that happened when I was in elementary school.
Wow.
And I got taken down by this memory just out of nowhere. And that was a huge other lesson in surrender. Grief is, you don't know when it's going to come.
No.
And that was something like I wanted to control it. I want, okay, anniversaries, birthdays, I'll put it in my calendar.
Yeah.
I will take care of myself that day. You know, and it was, I had to kind of laugh because I'm like, oh my God, there I go, trying to control my own grief.
Mm.
And then it comes at me like a freight train from behind.
What a lesson.
So it was that moment I was like, all right, fine.
You talk about actually, wait, I dog-eared the page in the book, and you talk about growth opportunities, the way you say AFGOs. One of my favorite terms is AFGO, A-F-G-A, or A-F-G-O, which stands for Another Fucking Growth Opportunity. AFGOs show up pretty regularly. Consider them invitations. We don't get better when the weather is calm and things are all unicorns farting rainbows. We get better when things fall apart and we pick the pieces back up.
True story, isn't it?
It's, I mean, I just think that is the truth with a capital T.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really do. We don't grow that much, I don't think, in times of extreme joy and happiness and, you know, but some the real diamonds of growth lie in the greatest challenges.
Yeah. I think it's Elizabeth Gilbert that has, like, one of the best quotes about how the women that she admires aren't the ones where things have gone smoothly. Like, the women she admires have had the emotional shit kicked out of them have fallen apart, and they figured it out and soldiered on. And, yeah, that's what that's about is, you know, some of my greatest teachers about relationships have been my exes who treated me so poorly and where I behaved so badly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in hindsight, looking back at that and owning my own stuff, and knowing that I didn't listen to my intuition, and knowing that I tolerated things that I should have never tolerated, et cetera. And I totally believe that. I think that I think that in the good times of joy and bliss that our hearts grow, but I think that it's when we go through these really hard times, whether it's grief or unmet expectations or frustrations or disappointments, et cetera, those are the times when our souls and our spirits really grow. And that's where I think most of our wisdom comes from, is that healed pain.
Yes, that's a great way to put it. I really like that. So true.
Mm-hmm.
So you have 14 habits in the book. What do you think are two or three of the most common for women entrepreneurs?
You know, I answer, whenever I get asked this question, it might sound a little bit different depending on whose audience I'm talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And for yours, I think that, oh gosh, it's a toss-up. I'm gonna spit out a couple, and then you can pinpoint which ones you want to talk about. I think perfectionism for sure. I think overachieving, yes. I think control. I also wonder about isolating and hiding out.
Mm-hmm.
That was towards the beginning of the book. What did you think about that one? Like when we're in struggle, instead of reaching out for help,
yep,
and sharing with someone our pain, mm-hmm, a lot of women tend to go inward and either procrastinate on reaching out or say to,
yep,
themselves, oh, Liz doesn't have time for my problems. Like, she's too busy.
Or also
I'm just
want
skip
to be
it.
Strong, right? Which is, of course, you,
yep,
know, another one.
Which is
right?
Another chapter.
Which, mm-hmm, is another chapter. And, you know, I think that there, and we were talking a little bit about it before our call, there's this thread that runs through so many of these habits that I think are very tied to, you know, sort of, and in quotation marks, I say high-powered women, you know, women,
mm-hmm,
who are just badass, you know, and who are doing a lot of things in the world, running businesses and raising children and helping nonprofits and traveling and, you know, doing things with their friends and their sisters and, you know, and it's a busy life. But I think things come up like the inner critic, I think like the imposter syndrome,
mm-hmm,
I think like, you know, trying to appear strong, right, and not asking for help, perfectionism for sure, that, you know, there are all these threads. So, I mean, I think if we just had to pick two or three, I mean, I think perfectionism is just definitely one of them. I mean, I can say that for myself. I mean,
I definitely think being strong, and I think it's something that doesn't get talked about a lot.
Yes, yes. And I think control. I think perfectionism,
mm-hmm,
control, and, you know, putting on a strong front.
Yeah, all masculine traits that you need in order to be successful and driven in business, don't you,
yes,
think?
Yes, I do. I do. And I think it's also a process of unlearning, because we talked,
yeah,
about how, you know, childhood can certainly affect us, and there are things that happen to all of us in one way or another. And I think society as a whole is not helpful, obviously,
oh, girl,
for women in,
yeah,
terms of, you know, we're supposed to be the good girl when we're young, and so we hold on to that when we get older, and hence, you know, a whole army of approval seekers and people pleasers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are all of these outside influences, and I think for women, they are using sort of traditional masculine traits, thinking that they need to, thinking that that's how they're going to get ahead, how they're going to be successful, versus using the more feminine traits of allowing and spaciousness,
yeah,
and openness,
mm-hmm,
to, you know, pull success towards them as opposed to having to push to make things happen. And I think it's a challenge for all of us, myself included.
Yeah. Well, it's finding that balance, and I don't think any of us do it perfectly. I think that we sort of, like, walk in a little bit, you know, blind, like, feeling our way around. Yeah, I can kind of only speak for myself. I don't know if y'all are doing it. But I love this topic for your audience particularly because, again, like I was just saying, it's we need those traits to kick ass in business, right, to be successful. And I remember when I first started hearing about this balance between masculine and feminine, and I was like, feminine? Like, I don't resonate with that at all. That's not my experience. And me personally, like, I'm an Aries. Every personality test that I take always comes back to the same, you know, that I have this strong, assertive personality. I am fiery, and I don't slow down. It's just the classic leadership qualities.
Mm-hmm.
And also the stereotypes that are involved in that, in being that woman who is a leader and is outspoken. We don't have a whole lot of media role models that paint that in a good light.
Right.
I mean, it's just been over the last few years, I was like, why does everybody hate Cruella De Vil so much? Like, she really knows what she wanted. all these villains, right? I mean, I just wrote a blog post and did a podcast episode on how much I've loved since I was a child, but never told anybody, how much I loved Cha-Cha De Gregorio from the movie Grease.
Oh, from Grease. Yeah, of course.
Everybody hated her. Everybody hated her. And I was always like, I've always really been drawn to strong Hispanic women, probably because my mother is one.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought she was so amazing. You know, she just meets these people and she tells them that she's the best dancer. She snatches the trophy out of the teacher's hand, like, yes, I just won this dance contest. Like, that kind of confidence is not painted very well in what we see growing up. And so I think it's definitely confusing for women on a lot of levels.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question. Well, so I wonder if we take, you know, a couple of the most common habits, which, you know, I think we've identified perfectionism,
mm-hmm.
maybe control, definitely being strong, maybe those three. I'd love to talk about perhaps one solution or one piece of advice that, you know, our listeners could walk away with for each of those three, you know, that they could start practicing in their life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, for sure. Okay, so let's start with perfectionism. I think one of my favorites is, and it kind of seems like a no-brainer, but so many of us don't do this, is to really be aware of the expectations that you have, both the expectations that you have of other people, but let's talk specifically about the expectations that you have of yourself.
Mm.
How often are we ever invited to write down exactly what the expectations are that we make of ourselves? Like, they're floating around in your mind. I invite people to write them down. And that could even look like your to-do list for the rest of the year or your goals for next year. And like, hey, I set goals. I set quarterly goals. I set goals left and right. And I think that those are really good. I'm not saying don't do those. But all the other, like, peripheral ancillary goals or expectations, I should say, like, are they realistic? Are you setting yourself up? Not for failure, but are you setting yourself up to really just exhaust yourself and kill yourself? And also, who are these expectations for?
Mm.
Are they really for you? Are they in complete alignment with the woman that you want to be and your values? Is this something that when you're 90 years old, you're going to look back and say, I'm so glad that I did that. I'm so glad I had those expectations of myself and that I accomplished them. Like, or are you doing it, again, to try to engineer your life to look a certain way for other people, for the benefit of other people, and not for the benefit of you?
Yeah.
That's one thing around perfectionism and being strong. Oh, my gosh. I loved writing that chapter so much, Liz. When I first wrote that chapter, my editor, she's like, I think that you really are passionate about this topic, but I think we should edit this part out. In the very beginning, try to find it. In the very beginning, I say something like, if being strong were a house, I would like to throw bricks through the window and light it on fire. What I originally had written there was, if being strong were a house, I'd like to throw a brick through the front window and set the motherfucker on fire.
Yeah.
They edited that part out. But I think that we wear that as a badge of honor.
Yeah.
We think that we can, you know, we decide that we can just soldier through. We don't need any help. And you know where this came from, where this chapter actually was born from? I was on Facebook one day, and I saw, it was like a friend of a friend had been in a car accident with her children in the car, and one of her children had died. And I'm reading all the comments, and this horrific thing that happened to this poor woman, and many, if not most of the comments said, stay strong. Be strong, mama. You got to be strong through this. And I was like, it just struck me. It was really interesting. And it made me think about why those people were telling her that over and over again. And I started thinking, I think that that is because we as a culture are uncomfortable with that much pain. We don't know what to say. And we are uncomfortable with the opposite of that, for her to fall apart, which she has every right in the world to fall apart. Her baby just died.
Yeah.
And for us to sit in that is entirely too uncomfortable. So I would like to turn that on its head. What it actually looks like to be strong. Personally, I think that being strong is feeling your feelings, whatever they are, leaning on other people when you need them, asking for help, because we cannot do this life by ourselves. We are wired to be in community and to lean on each other for help.
Yeah.
And that's, I get fired up with this topic. Maybe because I'm so damn tired of being strong.
And I really agree with you. I see that a lot. I have a friend who recently lost her sister, and, you know, I see reactions to grief, and mm-hmm. that's exactly it. And people are just very uncomfortable. They don't know how to deal with strong feelings. I mean, it's almost like, you know, I have a 4.5-year-old, and you know, so many of the parenting books that I've read talk about helping your toddler manage the strong feelings. Well, uh-huh. I mean, in reality, there are, you know, a lot of toddlers walking around in adult bodies. You know, not that everybody hasn't matured, but I mean, you know, I don't think that we are always taught how to deal with really strong feelings, and therefore we have a lot of adults walking around who are just really uncomfortable with that, both for themselves and experiencing strong feelings from other people.
Totally. I grew up in a family like that. You know, there was a lot of love in my family and attention and affection. I was very blessed in that way, but my parents did not know how to do or feel or talk about hard feelings. So if you had a problem, how I grew up, and I think this is very common, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and if you had a problem, you went and dealt with it on your own in your room for the most part. And there were some times where I felt comfortable coming to my parents, but for the most part, I did that by myself.
Yeah.
And even I remember my mother's brother died. So I think I was in maybe like the fifth grade, and I came home from school one day, and my dad was home early, which was sort of unusual. And he came out and said, "Your Uncle Gus died, and Mom's in our bedroom, and just kind of quiet, be quiet and leave her alone." For 3 days, she stayed in her pajamas. And I remember watching her, like, kind of shuffle down the hallway in her slippers, and that scared the shit out of me. Like, I did not know what was going on. I had never seen my mother in that state before, and it was, no one ever talked about it. No one. I didn't feel comfortable as a kid coming and saying, like, climbing in her bed and saying, you know, like, "Can you talk to me?" And it just, I remember that for the rest of my life, that I was afraid of that. Whatever that was over there, I was afraid of it, and it was something we did not talk about. It seemed very private, and just something you swept under the rug. And I vowed that that would not be the case in my house when I had children, that we were going to talk about this hard stuff. No, I am not going to bellow and carry on and be hysterical in front of my children. I think that there are emotional boundaries,
yep,
which I'm still trying to figure out, and I don't do them perfectly.
Aren't we all?
I do cry. I just talk about it to my kids, and
yes.
I feel like we don't give them enough credit. They are so much more smart and resilient than I ever thought children were.
I totally agree. I totally agree. And I think that it's so important for them to see us experience a spectrum of feelings and to see how we manage them and how we cope with them and deal with them and explain them and talk about them. It's just so much healthier.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
The whole concept of feelings has been so interesting and fascinating and such a learning thing for me, because the way I look at it now is I look at it from this perspective, is that, you know, when someone is sweating, like if you go to a spin class and you're sweating, you're not apologizing for all of your sweating, and no one's like really uncomfortable, you know, unless you're in like a corporate meeting or something like that, but it's like it's just normal. Your body is doing what it needs to do. Same with sneezing, same with, like, although gross, like throwing up and farting. Like, it's just like, this is our body's way of like staying at homeostasis. I really feel that feelings are the same thing. Mm. Our body knows what to do. And when it's grief and crying and things like that, same thing. Just like get it out. It's just salt water coming out of your body.
Mm-hmm.
That's what tears are. It's the same as sweat. Like, wouldn't the culture be so interesting if we looked at feelings the same way we looked at sweating or sneezing? Same.
Yep. they
It would
wouldn't
be
have
so
the
interesting.
interest that they do. My old therapist always used to say that, you know, when you don't deal with feelings, when you don't allow yourself to process, it will always come out sideways.
Always.
Right? So they always get embedded somewhere in your body. And somewhere along the line, you're going to get a curveball and something's going to come out sideways from those unprocessed feelings. It's really, and it's, I've seen it many, many times and felt it myself. It's fascinating.
That's where violence comes from.
Yeah.
That's where, I mean, it's just, it's a way of offloading those emotions. That's what I consider sideways is, it's offloading.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Same concept.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, you know, this is sort of a big question because there's so much great content in this book. It really, Andrea, it's such an awesome book, and everyone listening, you know, needs to go and get it. It's available now, How to Stop Feeling Like Shit, 14 Habits That Are Holding You Back from Happiness. You know, if a woman is reading your book, you know, what are one or two things that you really want her to walk away with? And, you know, obviously there's so much in here, and, you know, not everyone is going to, I think, you know, necessarily connect with all of the 14 habits. I think you're going to find yourself in this book, and there are going to be certain ones. Like when I read it, I said, oh, yep, that's me. Yep, that
mm-hmm.
one is me. That one, not so much, but the other five, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm curious what you would want, you know, a woman reading this book to walk away with.
I think it's a couple of things, you know, based on this conversation that you just had, is I want to underscore again that it's about knowing when you are in that behavior so that you can work on doing something else. And I'm going to talk about what that something else is in just a second. But again, these behaviors work a little bit for some people, and it is going to be kind of that flip-flopping, as you put it, back and forth.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that I think is so important, is just foundational in the work that I do with any private client or in any class, and that is getting to know exactly what your values are and what they look like. And that's the very last chapter of the book that we haven't talked about today, but it's part of the bigger solution for all of these behaviors, because no one has, you might have a value around excellence and being of service, but you don't have a value around perfectionism and people pleasing. And when you are really clear on what your values are, and more specifically, what they actually look like, then you are more clear about your behaviors and what you actually want to be doing. And sometimes that means having hard conversations and making requests of people and setting boundaries and maybe walking away from certain relationships and walking away from certain jobs or making a request. And then, like, all of these things that are uncomfortable, right, and that are going to be asking a lot of you, asking you to call on your courage and your confidence, maybe while you're sweating and wringing your hands. And but it's like one of those things where kind of both of those choices feel like shit, you know, whether either we people please or, you know, isolate and hide out or numb out, or we try to set a boundary and ask for a raise or things like that. Both of those are uncomfortable. We've just gotten used to the former and you know, doing all of these behaviors that we know. But really, the woman that you actually want to be is based in those values. And my life changed when I figured out exactly what my values look like. And it was kind of like one of those, like, oh, my God, this is why I feel like crap so much, is because, you know, anytime you get pissed off about something, it's out of alignment of your values. That's a great place to look. You know, like, anytime mm-hmm. you are pissed off, one of your values is being stepped on. So again, I cannot emphasize that enough, how important it is to get really clear on what your values look like, how you want to live your life, what's important about your life and how you live it.
I love that. And, you know, it's so interesting, you know, you're talking about discomfort avoidance, right? And the reality is there's no way to avoid discomfort in life. So we might as well, you know, start practicing these things that are going to start helping us to feel better and feel stronger
yeah.
and have stronger boundaries, even though they might feel uncomfortable at first. It's almost like working that muscle, because the reverse
exactly.
is we're still going to feel discomfort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
anyway,
which way
you
want.
It. Yeah. I love that. I love that. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Andrea, this has been great. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat and for being here. I really appreciate it, and I know all of our listeners do too.
Thank you so much, Liz.
And we can still find you at yourkickasslife.com, right?
Yeah, I'm still there, and I'm also doing a free book club for anyone that purchases the book. That doesn't start until January 22nd, so there's time for people to get in that. And I mean, raise your hand if you've ever bought a self-help book, help book and never read it, or
right.
bought it and just, like, consumed the information and not done anything in it. So I wanted to offer that support for women who are really ready to put some of these things into action, and that's all over at yourkickasslife.com/HTSSLS. It's an acronym for How to Stop Feeling Like Shit, and they can find links to buy the book there, as well as clicking on claim bonuses will get you signed up for that class.
Okay, awesome. We'll include that link in the blog post where we have the call, so that, you know, anybody that purchases the book, which you guys definitely should go do at Amazon.com, can participate. And you said that starts January 22nd?
Correct.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Andrea, thank you so much again for being here. I so appreciate it. It's been such a great conversation.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.